to leave her uncomfortable house for fear of displeasing the landlord. "Your plan of retirement," she said, "is charming, and I like it very much. But in such retirement we should have to live. If I leave my prison, I run the risk of losing my bread. And when this fails us in the woods, we shall be obliged to return again to town to look for it. To lessen the chance of being obliged to do so, do not let us leave the town altogether. Let us pay this trifling annuity to the Comte de Saint-Laurent, that he may leave me mine. Let us look for some retreat, far enough from the town to allow us to live in peace, and near enough for us to return to it whenever it is necessary." This was what we did. After looking about a little, we settled upon Les Charmettes, an estate belonging to Monsieur de Conzier, close to Chambéry, but as retired and solitary as if it had been 100 leagues away. Between two rather high hills, there is a little valley extending from north to south, at the bottom of which a stream of water runs amongst the trees and pebbles. Along this valley, halfway up the hill, there are some scattered houses, a very pleasant retreat for anyone who is fond of a somewhat wild and retired asylum. Having looked at two or three of these houses, we at last chose the nicest, which belonged to a gentleman in the army, named Noiret. The house was very habitable. In front was a garden with a terrace, above that a vineyard, and below an orchard. Facing it was a little forest of chestnut trees, and a fountain close by. Higher up on the mountain were pasture meadows, in short, everything requisite for the little country establishment we intended to set up. As far as I can remember times and dates, we took possession of it towards the end of the summer of 1736. I was delighted the first night we slept there. "Oh, Mama," said I to my dear friend, while I embraced her with tears of tenderness and joy, "this is the abode of happiness and innocence. If we do not find both here, it will be useless to look for them anywhere else." Book 6, 1736. Hoc erat in votis, modus agri non ita magnus, hortus ubi et tecto vicinus jugis aquae fons, et paulum silvae super his foret. This used to be the height of my wishes, a small piece of land with a garden, a stream of running water near the house, and a little wood besides. I cannot add, auctius atque, de melius fecere. Horace, Satire 2, 6, 1-4. In fact, I cannot add, the gods have blessed me with more than I desire. But no matter. I had no need of more. I did not even need any property at all. The enjoyment of it was enough for me, and I have long ago said and felt that the proprietor and the possessor are often two very different persons, even if one leaves husbands and lovers out of the question. At this period commences the brief happiness of my life. Here approach the peaceful but rapid moments which have given me the right to say, I have lived. Precious and regretted moments. Begin again for me your delightful course, and if it be possible, pass more slowly in succession through my memory than you did in your fugitive reality. What can I do to prolong, as I should like, this touching and simple narrative? To repeat the same things over and over again, without wearying my readers by such repetition, any more than I was wearied of them myself when I recommenced the life again and again? If all this consisted of facts, actions, and words, I could describe, and in a manner give an idea of them. But how is it possible to describe what was neither said nor done, nor even thought, but enjoyed and felt, without being able to assign any other reason for my happiness than this simple feeling? I got up at sunrise and was happy. I walked and was happy. I saw Mama and was happy. I left her and was happy. I roamed the forests and hills, I wandered in the valleys, I read, I did nothing. I worked in the garden, I picked the fruit, I helped in the work of the house, and happiness followed me everywhere, happiness which could not be referred to any definite object, but dwelt entirely within myself, and which never left me for a single instant. Nothing that occurred to me during that delightful period, nothing that I did, said, or thought, during all the time it lasted, has escaped my memory. Preceding and subsequent periods only come back to me at intervals. I recall them unequally and confusedly, but I recall this particular period in its entirety, as if it still existed. My fancy, which during my youth always looked ahead, and now always looks back, compensates me by these charming recollections for the hope which I have lost forever. I no longer see anything in the future to tempt me. Only the reminiscences of the past can flatter me, and these reminiscences of the period of which I speak, so vivid and so true, often make my life happy in spite of my misfortunes. I will mention one single instant of these recollections, which will enable the reader to judge of their liveliness and accuracy. The first day we set out to pass the night at Les Charmettes, Mama was in a sedan chair, and I followed on foot. The road was somewhat steep, and being rather heavy and afraid of tiring her bearers, she got down about halfway, intending to finish the rest of the journey on foot. During the walk she saw something blue in the hedge and said to me, "Look, there is some periwinkle still in flower." I had never seen any periwinkle. I did not stoop down to examine it, and I am too near-sighted to distinguish plants on the ground when standing upright. I merely cast a passing glance at it, and nearly 30 years passed before I saw any periwinkle again, or paid any attention to it. In 1764, when I was at Cressier with my friend Duperreau, we were climbing a hill, on the top of which he has built a pretty salon, which he rightly calls Belle Vue. I was then beginning to botanize a little. While ascending the hill and looking amongst the bushes, I exclaimed with a cry of joy, "Ah, there is some periwinkle!" As in fact it was. Duperreau observed my delight, without knowing the cause of it. He will learn it, I hope, one day, when he reads these words. The reader may judge, from the impression which so trifling a circumstance made upon me, of the effect produced by everything which has reference to that period. In the meantime, the country air did not restore me to my former state of health. I was sickly, and grew worse. I could not take milk, and was obliged to give it up. At that time, hydropathy was the rage, as a cure for every complaint. I rushed into it with so little discretion that it nearly put an end, not to my ailments, but to my life. Every morning, when I got up, I went to the spring with a large goblet, and walking about, drank about 2 bottlefuls without stopping. I entirely gave up drinking wine at my meals. The water which I drank was rather hard and difficult to pass, like most mountain waters. In short, I managed so well that in less than 2 months I completely ruined my stomach, which had hitherto been excellent, and I recognized that I could no longer hope to be cured, as I was totally incapable of digesting anything. At the same time, an accident occurred to me, as curious in itself as in its results, which will only end with my life. One morning, when I was no worse than usual, while lifting the top of a little table upon its stand, I became conscious of a sudden and almost incomprehensible disturbance in my whole body. I cannot compare it better than with a kind of storm, which arose in my blood, and in a moment gained the mastery over all my limbs. My veins began to beat so violently that I not only felt, but even heard it, especially the beating of the carotid arteries. This was accompanied by a loud noise in my ears, of 3, or rather 4, kinds: a dull and heavy buzzing, a more distinct murmur like that of running water, a sharp whistling sound, and the beating which I have just described, the pulsations of which I could easily count, without feeling my pulse or touching my body with my hands. This internal noise was so loud that it deprived me of my hitherto keen faculties of hearing, and made me not altogether deaf, but hard of hearing, as I have continued to be from that day. My surprise and affright may easily be imagined. I looked upon myself as dead. I took to my bed, and the physician was sent for. Trembling with fear, I told him my case, which I considered hopeless. I believe he thought the same, but he acted as became his profession. He strung together a series of lengthy explanations, of which I understood nothing. Then, in consequence of his sublime theory, he commenced, in anima vili, the experimental cure which he was pleased to try. It was so painful, so disgusting, and produced so little effect, that I soon became tired of it, and at the end of a few weeks, finding myself neither better nor worse, I left my bed and resumed my ordinary occupations. Although the beating of my arteries and the buzzing in my ears still continued, and in fact have never left me for a moment from that day, that is to say, for 30 years. Hitherto I had been a great sleeper. The total inability to sleep, by which all these symptoms have been accompanied, even to the present day, finally convinced me that I had not long to live. This conviction at first calmed my anxiety to recover. As I could not prolong my life, I resolved to get as much as possible out of the few years or months that remained to me. And this I was enabled to do, thanks to a special favour of nature, which, notwithstanding my melancholy condition, gave me exemption from the pain by which it would naturally have been accompanied. I was inconvenienced by the noise, but it caused me no suffering. The only habitual inconveniences by which it was attended were inability to sleep at night, and a perpetual shortness of breath, not, however, amounting to asthma, and which only made itself felt when I attempted to run or exert myself more than usual. This accident, which should have killed my body, only killed my passions, and I bless heaven every day for the happy effect which it produced upon my soul. I can certainly say that I never began to live until I looked upon myself as a dead man. While estimating at their true value the things I was going to leave, I began to occupy my thoughts with nobler cares, as if in anticipation of the duties I should soon have to fulfil, and which until then I had seriously neglected. I had often burlesqued religion after my own fashion, but I had never been entirely without it. It was easier for me to hark back to this subject, so melancholy for so many, but so sweet for one who can find in it a source of hope and consolation. On this occasion, Mamma was far more useful to me than all the theologians in the world could have been. As she always reduced everything to a system, she had not failed to treat religion in the same manner. Her system of religion was made up of ideas of the most different kinds, some very sensible, others very foolish, of feelings connected with her character, and of prejudices arising from her education. As a rule, believers make God like themselves. The good represent him as good, the wicked as wicked. Malicious and bilious devotees see nothing but hell, because they would like to see the whole world damned, while loving and gentle souls do not believe in the existence of such a place. I have never been able to recover from my astonishment at finding the good Fénelon speak of it in his Telemachus, as if he sincerely believed in it. But I hope that he lied then, for, after all, however truthful a man may be, he is obliged to lie sometimes, when he is a bishop. Mamma did not lie to me, and her soul, free from gall and bitterness, which could not imagine a vindictive and ever wrathful God, saw only mercy and compassion, where devotees see nothing but retributive justice and punishment. She often used to say that if God were to be strictly just towards us, it would not be justice on his part, since he has not made us such as to require it, and would in such a case require from us more than he has given. The curious thing was that, while not believing in hell, she still believed in purgatory. The reason of this was that she did not know what to do with the souls of the wicked, feeling unable either to damn them or to put them with the good until they had become good themselves. In fact, it must be confessed that, both in this world and the next, the wicked are always a source of considerable embarrassment. Another of her curious ideas was the following. It is obvious that the whole doctrine of original sin and redemption is destroyed by this system, that the foundations of ordinary Christianity are shaken, and that Catholicism, at any rate, cannot exist. Mamma, however, was a good Catholic, or professed to be one, and certainly in all good faith. It seemed to her that people were accustomed to explain the Scriptures too literally and too harshly. All that we read in them about eternal torments was, according to her, to be taken only as a threat, or in a figurative sense. The death of Jesus Christ appeared to her an example of truly divine charity, to teach men to love God and one another in the same manner. In a word, true to the religion which she had adopted, she accepted in all sincerity its entire profession of faith. But when it came to a discussion of each article, it was manifest that her belief was quite different from that of the Church, to which she always professed submission. In reference to this, she displayed a simplicity of heart and a frankness which was more eloquent than petty cavillings, and which frequently embarrassed even her confessor, from whom she concealed nothing. "I am a good Catholic, and desire always to remain one," she used to say to him. "I submit with my whole heart to the decisions of Holy Mother Church. I am not mistress of my belief, but I am mistress of my will, which I control without reserve, and am prepared to believe everything. What more can you ask of me?" Even had no Christian morality existed, I believe she would have followed its principles, since they harmonized so completely with her character. She did all that was prescribed, but she would have done it just the same, even if it had not been prescribed. In unimportant matters, she liked to show her obedience. And if it had not been permitted, even if she had been ordered, to eat meat on fast days, she would have fasted in order to please God, without any regard for considerations dictated by prudence. But all these principles of morality were subordinated to the principles of Monsieur de Tavel, or rather, she declared that she found nothing contradictory therein. She would have slept every day with 20 men with a calm conscience, and without feeling any more scruple than desire in the matter. I know that many devotees are not more scrupulous on this point, but the difference is that, while they are led astray by their passions, she was only misled by her sophisms. In the course of the most touching, I even venture to say the most edifying, conversations, she would have been able to allude to this matter without any alteration of tone or manner, and without thinking that she was in the least inconsistent. She would even, if necessary, have interrupted such a conversation to speak of the subject, and would have been able to resume it as calmly as before, so intimate was her conviction that the whole matter was only a principle of social economy, which every intelligent person was at liberty to interpret, apply, or reject, according to his or her view of the matter, without the least danger of offending God. Although I certainly did not share her opinion upon this point, I confess that I never ventured to contradict her, since I was ashamed of the lack of politeness which such conduct on my part would have forced me to exhibit. I might certainly have endeavoured to establish a rule for others, and attempted to make an exception in my own case, but not only was her temperament a sufficient protection against the abuse of her principles, but I knew that she was not a woman to be easily deceived, and if I had claimed exception for myself, I should only have left it for her to grant it to anyone else who might be agreeable to her. Besides, I only mention this inconsistency incidentally by the side of the rest, although it has never had much influence upon her conduct, and at that time had none at all. But I have promised to give a faithful account of her principles, and I wish to fulfil this promise. Let me now return to myself. As I found in her all the principles which I needed in order to fortify my soul against the terrors of death and its consequences, I drew upon this source of confidence with perfect security. I became more closely attached to her than I'd ever been. I should have been willing to hand over to her entirely the life which I felt was ready to leave me. The result of this redoubled attachment to her, of the conviction that I had only a short time to live, of the profound calmness with which I contemplated my future state, was an habitual condition of tranquillity, even of enjoyment, which, while it allayed all those passions, which remove our hopes and fears to a distance, permitted me to enjoy, without anxiety or trouble, the few days which remained to me. Another thing helped to make them more agreeable. the endeavour to foster her taste for country life by every amusement that I could think of. While I made her fond of her garden, her poultry yard, her pigeons and her cows, I myself acquired a liking for them all, and these trifling occupations, which filled up my day without disturbing my tranquillity, did me more good than the milk and all other remedies employed to keep my poor machine in order, and even repaired it as far as was possible. The vintage and the gathering of the fruit amused us for the remainder of this year, and made us more and more attached to country life, amongst the good people by whom we were surrounded. We were very sorry to see the approach of winter, and went back to town as if we'd been going into exile, myself especially, since I did not think that I should live to see the spring again, and believed that I was saying good-bye to Les Charmettes for the last time. Before I left, I kissed the ground and the trees, and turned back several times as I went on my way. As I had long given up my pupils and lost my taste for the amusements and society of the town, I never went out and never saw anybody, except Mama and Monsieur Salomon, who had recently become her physician and mine, an honourable and intelligent man, a strong Cartesian, who talked sensibly about the system of the world, and whose agreeable and instructive conversation did me more good than all his prescriptions. A Cartesian is a follower of the doctrines of Descartes. I have never been able to endure the silly and nonsensical padding of ordinary conversation, but serious and useful discourse always affords me great pleasure, and I never refuse to take part in it. I took great delight in Monsieur Salomon's conversation. It seemed to me that, while in his company, I was acquiring a foretaste of that higher knowledge, which was reserved for my soul, when it had lost the fetters which confined it. My predilection for him extended to the subjects which he discussed, and I began to look for books which might help me to understand him better. Those which combined devotion and science were most suitable for me, particularly those of the Oratory and Port Royal, which I began to read, or rather to devour. Port Royal was the school of the Jansenists. I came across one written by Father Lamy entitled Entretien sur les sciences, a kind of introduction to the knowledge of those books which treated of them. I read and reread it 100 times, and resolved to make it my guide. At last I felt myself, in spite of, or rather by reason of, my condition, gradually and irresistibly attracted to study, and while looking upon each day as my last, I studied with as great eagerness as if I had been destined to live for ever. I was told that this was injurious to me. I believe that it was beneficial, not only to my mind, but also to my body. For this occupation, to which I passionately devoted myself, became so delightful to me that I no longer thought of my sufferings, and was much less affected by them. It is certainly true that nothing afforded me any real relief, but as I felt no acute pain, I became accustomed to languor and sleeplessness, to thought instead of action, and at last I came to look upon the slow and gradual decay of my powers as an unavoidable process, which death alone could arrest. Not only did this opinion release me from all idle and earthly cares, but it also delivered me from the annoyance of the various remedies to which hitherto I had been obliged to submit, in spite of myself. Salomon, convinced that his drugs could not cure me, spared me the unpleasantness of taking them, and was content to soothe poor Mama's grief with some of those harmless prescriptions which deceive the sick man with hopes, and keep up the reputation of the physician. I gave up strict diet, began to take wine again, and as far as my strength allowed me, led the life of a man in perfect health, temperate in everything, but denying myself nothing. I even went out sometimes, and began to visit my acquaintances again, especially Monsieur de Conzier, whose society I found very agreeable. In short, whether it was that I thought it a fine thing to keep on learning till my last hour, or that some slight hope of life still remained concealed at the bottom of my heart, the expectation of death, far from diminishing my taste for study, seemed rather to enliven it, and I made great haste to pick up a little knowledge for the next world, as if I had believed that in it I should only possess such knowledge as I took with me. I became fond of the bookshop of a Monsieur Bouchard, frequented by several men of letters, and as the spring, which I had never expected to live to see, was close at hand, I looked out some books to take to Les Charmettes, in case I should have the good fortune to return there. I had this good fortune, and I made the best use of it. The joy with which I beheld the first buds is indescribable. To me it was like a resurrection in paradise to see the spring again. No sooner had the snow begun to melt than we left our dungeon and arrived at Les Charmettes soon enough to hear the first notes of the nightingale. From that time I no longer thought of dying, and it is really remarkable that I've never had any serious illness in the country. I have suffered much there, but have never been confined to my bed. I've often said, when feeling more than usually unwell, "When you see me at the point of death, carry me under the shade of an oak. I promise you that I shall get well again." Although still weak, I resumed my country occupations, but to an extent proportionate to my powers. I was truly grieved not to be able to see after the garden alone, but after a half a dozen digs with the spade, I was quite out of breath. The sweat poured down my face, and I felt quite exhausted. When I stooped, my palpitations increased, and the blood flew to my head with such violence that I was obliged to stand upright immediately. Compelled to confine myself to less fatiguing occupations, I undertook, amongst other things, the care of the pigeon-house, to which I became so strongly attached that I often spent several hours in succession there without feeling a moment's weariness. The pigeon is a very timid creature and difficult to tame. However, I succeeded in inspiring mine with such confidence that they followed me everywhere, and allowed me to catch them whenever I wanted. I could not show myself in the garden or court without immediately finding two or three of them on my arms and head. And at last, in spite of the pleasure this afforded me, this following became so troublesome to me that I was obliged to discourage their excessive familiarity. I have always found singular pleasure in taming animals, especially such as are shy and wild. It appeared to me delightful to inspire them with a confidence which I have never abused. I desired their fondness for me to be perfectly unrestricted. I have mentioned that I took some books with me, but I made use of them in a manner less calculated to instruct than to overwhelm me. The false idea which I entertained of things caused me to believe that, in order to read a book with profit, it was necessary to possess all the preliminary knowledge which it presupposed. I had no suspicion that very frequently the author himself did not possess it, and that he extracted it from other books as he required it. Possessed by this foolish idea, I was detained every moment, and obliged to run incessantly from one book to another. Sometimes, before I had reached the 10th page of the work I wanted to study, I should have been obliged to exhaust the contents of whole libraries. However, I followed this senseless method so persistently that I lost an enormous amount of time, and my head became so confused that I almost lost the power of seeing or comprehending anything. Happily, I at last perceived that I was on the wrong track, which was leading me astray in an interminable labyrinth, and I left it before I was quite lost in it. The first thing that strikes anyone who has a genuine taste for learning, however slight, when he devotes himself to it, is the close connection of the sciences, which causes them to attract, support, and throw light upon each other, so that one cannot dispense with the other. Although the human intellect is not capable of mastering all, and one must always be regarded as the principal object of study, yet, without some idea of the rest, a man often finds himself in the dark in his own particular branch. I felt that what I had undertaken was good and useful in itself, and that all that was necessary was a change of method. Taking the encyclopedia first, I had divided it into its different branches. I saw that I should have done exactly the opposite, that I ought to have taken each branch separately and followed it up to the point at which all unite. Thus I return to the ordinary synthetical method, but like a man who knows what he is about. In this, meditation supplied the place of knowledge, and a very natural reflection helped me on the right road. Whether I lived or died, I had no time to lose. A man who, at the age of 25, knows nothing and wishes to learn everything, is bound to make the best use of his time. Not knowing at what point destiny or death might arrest my zeal, I desired, in any case, to get an idea of everything, in order to discover the special bent of my natural abilities, and also to judge for myself what was worthy of cultivation. In the execution of this plan, I found another advantage which had not occurred to me, that of economizing my time. I certainly cannot have been born for study, for continuous application tires me to such an extent, that I am utterly unable to devote more than half an hour together to the close study of the same subject, especially when following another's train of thought. For it sometimes happened that I have been able to devote myself to my own ideas longer, and even with tolerable success. When I have read a few pages of an author who must be read carefully, my mind wanders from him and is lost in the clouds. If I persist, I exhaust myself to no purpose. I become dazed and cease to see anything. But if different subjects follow each other, even without interruption, one relieves me from the other, and without feeling the need of any relaxation, I follow them more easily. I profited by this observation in my plan of study, and I combined them in such a manner that I was busy the whole day without ever fatiguing myself. It is true that rural and domestic occupations afforded me useful distractions, but in my increasing zeal I soon found means to spare time from these to devote to study, and to busy myself with two kinds of things at the same time, without thinking that the result in each case was less satisfactory. In these trifling details, which afford me delight, and with which I often weary my reader, I nevertheless exercise a reserve which he would scarcely suspect, unless I took care to inform him. Here, for example, I remember with delight all the various attempts I made to distribute my time in such a manner as to derive from it as much pleasure and profit as possible. And I can say that this period, during which I lived in retirement and always in ill health, was the period of my life during which I was least idle and least wearied. 2 or 3 months were thus spent in trying the bent of my mind, and in enjoying, in the most beautiful season of the year, and in a spot which it rendered delightful, the charm of life, the value of which I so well appreciated, the charm of an unrestrained and sweet companionship, if such a name can be given to a union so perfect, and of the wonderful knowledge which I proposed to acquire, for it seemed to me as if I already possessed it, or rather, it was still better, since the pleasure of learning counted for much in my happiness. I must pass over these attempts, which were all a source of enjoyment to me, but are too simple to be satisfactorily expressed. I repeat, true happiness cannot be described, it can only be felt. And felt the more, the less it can be described, since it is not the result of a number of facts, but is a permanent condition. I often repeat myself, but I should do so still more if I said the same thing as often as it occurs to me. When my frequently changed manner of life had at last adopted a regular course, it was distributed as nearly as possible in the following manner. I got up every day before sunrise. I climbed through a neighbouring orchard to a very pretty path above the vineyard which ran along the slope, as far as Chambéry. During my walk I offered a prayer, which did not consist merely of idle, stammering words, but of a sincere uplifting of the heart to the Creator of this delightful nature, whose beauties were spread before my eyes. I never like to pray in a room. It has always seemed to me as if the walls and all the petty handiwork of man interposed between myself and God. I love to contemplate him in his works, while my heart uplifts itself to him. My prayers were pure, I venture to say, and for that reason deserved to be heard. I only asked for myself and for her, who was inseparably associated with my wishes, an innocent and peaceful life, free from vice, pain and distressing needs, the death of the righteous and their lot in the future. For the rest, this act of worship consisted rather of admiration and contemplation than of request, for I knew that the best means of obtaining the blessings which are necessary for us from the giver of all true blessings was to deserve rather than ask for them. My walk consisted of a tolerably long round, during which I contemplated with interest and pleasure the rustic scenery by which I was surrounded, the only thing of which heart and eye never tire. From a distance I looked to see if it was day with Mamma. When I saw her shutters open, I trembled with joy and ran towards the house. If they were shut, I remained in the garden until she awoke, amusing myself by going over what I'd learned the evening before, or by gardening. The shutters opened. I went to embrace her while she was still in bed, often still half asleep. And this embrace, as pure as it was tender, derived from its very innocence a charm which is never combined with sensual pleasure. We usually took café au lait for breakfast. This was the period of the day when we were most undisturbed, and chatted most at our ease. We usually sat a considerable time over our breakfast, and from that time I've always had a great liking for this meal. I infinitely prefer the fashion of the Swiss and English, with whom breakfast is really a meal at which all the family assemble, to that of the French, who breakfast separately in their rooms, or, most commonly, take no breakfast at all. After an hour or two of conversation, I went to my books till dinner. I began with some philosophical treatises, such as The Logic of Port-Royal, Locke's Essays, Malebranche, Leibniz, Descartes, etc. I soon observed that all these authors nearly always contradicted each other, and I conceived the fanciful idea of reconciling them, which fatigued me greatly, and made me lose considerable time. I muddled my head without making any progress. At last, abandoning this plan, I adopted one that was infinitely better, to which I attribute all the progress which, in spite of my want of talent, I may have made. For it is certain that I never had much capacity for study. As I read each author, I made a practice of adopting and following up all his ideas, without any admixture of my own or those of anyone else, and without ever attempting to argue with him. I said to myself, let me begin by laying up a store of ideas, no matter whether they be true or false, provided only they are definite, until my head is sufficiently equipped with them to be able to select and compare them. I know that this method is not without its inconveniences, but it has answered my purpose of self-instruction. After I had spent some years in thinking exactly as others thought, without, so to speak, reflecting and almost without reasoning, I found myself in possession of a fund of learning sufficient to satisfy myself and to enable me to think without the assistance of another. Then, when travelling and business matters deprived me of the opportunity of consulting books, I amused myself by going over and comparing what I had read, by weighing everything in the scale of reason, and sometimes by passing judgment upon my masters. I did not find that my critical faculties had lost their vigour owing to my having begun to exercise them late. And when I published my own ideas, I have never been accused of being a servile disciple, or of swearing in verba magistri, by the words of a master, an allusion to the disciples of Pythagoras, who slavishly reproduced the ideas of their master. From these studies, I proceeded to elementary geometry, beyond which I never advanced, although I persistently attempted, in some degree, to overcome my weakness of memory by dint of retracing my steps hundreds of times, and by incessantly going over the same ground. I did not like Euclid, whose object is rather a chain of proofs than the connection of ideas. I preferred Father Lamy's Geometry, which from that time became one of my favourite works, and which I am still able to read with pleasure. Next came Algebra, in which I still took Father Lamy for my guide. When I was more advanced, I took Father Reynaud's Science of Calculation, then his Analysis Demonstrated, which I merely skimmed. I have never got so far as to understand properly the application of algebra to geometry. I did not like this method of working without knowing what I was doing, and it appeared to me that solving a geometrical problem by means of equations was like playing a tune by simply turning the handle of a barrel organ. The first time that I found by calculation that the square of a binomial was composed of the square of each of its parts, added to twice the product of those parts, in spite of the correctness of my multiplication, I would not believe it until I had drawn the figure. I had considerable liking for algebra, in so far as it dealt with abstract quantities. But when it was applied to space and dimensions, I wanted to see the operation explained by lines. Otherwise, I was entirely unable to comprehend it. After this came Latin. I found this my most difficult task, and I've never made much progress in it. At first, I began with the Port Royal method, but without result. Its barbarous verses disgusted me, and my ear could never retain them. The mass of rules confused me, and when learning the last, I forgot all that had preceded it. A man who has no memory does not want to study words, and it was just in order to strengthen my memory that I persisted in this study, which I was finally obliged to abandon. I was sufficiently acquainted with the construction to be able to read an easy author with the help of a dictionary. I kept to this plan with tolerable success. I limited myself to translations, not written, but mental. By dint of continual practice, I was able to read the Latin authors with tolerable ease, but I have never been able to speak or write in that language, which frequently caused me embarrassment when I found myself, I know not how, enrolled a member of the Society of Men of Letters. Another disadvantage resulting from this method of learning is that I have never learned prosody, still less the rules of versification. However, in my desire to feel the harmony of the language in verse as well as prose, I made great efforts to succeed in this, but I am convinced that it is impossible without the aid of a master. After I had learned the structure of the easiest of all verses, the hexameter, I had sufficient patience to scan nearly the whole of Virgil, marking the feet and quantities. Then, when I afterwards had any doubt whether a syllable was long or short, I referred to my Virgil. It may easily be conceived that this made me commit many errors, in consequence of the license allowed by the rules of versification. But if there is an advantage in self-instruction, there are also great disadvantages, especially the incredible amount of labour necessary. This I know better than anyone else. Before noon I left my books, and if dinner was not ready, I paid a visit to my friends, the Pigeons, or worked in the garden until it was. When I heard myself called, I was very glad to run to table, provided with an excellent appetite. For it is a remarkable thing that, however ill I may be, my appetite never fails. We dined very pleasantly, talking of our affairs, until Mamma was able to eat. Two or three times a week, when it was fine, we took our coffee in a cool and shady arbour behind the house, which I had decorated with hops, which made it very agreeable during the heat. We spent some little time in looking at our vegetables and flowers, and in talking about our mode of life, which heightened the enjoyment of it. I had another little family at the bottom of the garden, some bees. I rarely failed to visit them, and Mamma often accompanied me. I took great interest in their work. It amused me immensely to see them returning from their foraging expeditions, their little legs often so loaded that they could scarcely move. At first my curiosity made me too inquisitive, and I was stung two or three times. But at last they got to know me so well that they let me go as close to them as I pleased. And however full their hives were, when they were ready to swarm, I had them all round me, on my hands and on my face, without ever getting stung. All animals rightly distrust human beings, but when they once feel sure that they do not mean to hurt them, their confidence becomes so great that a man must be worse than a barbarian to abuse it. I returned to my books, but my afternoon occupations deserved less to be called work and study than recreation and amusement. I've never been able to endure close application in my room after dinner, and generally speaking, any effort during the heat of the day is painful to me. However, I occupied myself with reading without study, without restraint, and almost without any system. My most regular occupations were history and geography, and as these did not require any great effort of mind, I made as much progress as was possible, considering my weak memory. I tried to study Father Petaut, and plunged into the obscurities of chronology, but I was disgusted by the critical portion of it, which is most intricate, and by preference I took up the study of the exact measurement of time and the course of the heavenly bodies. I should also have become fond of astronomy, if I'd had the necessary appliances, but I was obliged to content myself with a few elementary principles, learnt from books, and some crude observations which I made with a telescope, merely to learn the general idea of the situation of the heavenly bodies. For my short-sightedness does not allow me to distinguish the stars clearly with the naked eye. In regard to this, I remember an adventure, which has often made me laugh since. I had bought an astronomical chart in order to study the constellations. I fastened this chart to a frame, and when the nights were clear, I went into the garden and placed my frame on four stakes about my own height, with the chart turned downwards. In order to prevent the wind from blowing out my candle, I put it in a pail, which I placed between the four stakes on the ground. Then, looking alternately at the map with my eyes and the stars with my telescope, I practiced myself in distinguishing the constellations and the individual stars. I think I have mentioned that Monsieur Noiret's garden was in the form of a terrace, so that everything that took place could be seen from the road. One evening some peasants, who were passing by at rather a late hour, saw me, most comically attired, busy at my work. The dim light which fell upon my chart, without their being able to see where it came from, since it was hidden from their eyes by the edges of the pail, the four stakes, the large sheet of paper covered with figures, the frame, and the movements of my telescope, which kept appearing and disappearing, gave an air of witchcraft to the whole proceeding, which terrified them. My dress was not calculated to reassure them. A broad-brimmed hat over my cap, and a short, wadded nightdress belonging to Mama, which she had forced me to put on, presented to their eyes the appearance of a real sorcerer. And, as it was nearly midnight, they had no doubt that a witches' meeting was going to commence. Feeling little curiosity to see any more, they ran away in great alarm, woke up their neighbours to tell them of the apparition they had seen, and the story spread so quickly that, on the following day, everyone in the neighbourhood knew that a witches' gathering had been held in Monsieur Noiret's garden. I do not know what would have been the result of this rumour, had not one of the peasants, who had been a witness of my incantations, carried a complaint on the same day to two Jesuits, who often came to see us, and who, without knowing what it was all about, in the meantime disabused them of the idea. They told us the story, I told them the origin of it, and we enjoyed a hearty laugh over it. However, it was decided, for fear of its being repeated, that for the future I should take my observations without the assistance of a light, and that I should consult my chart at home. Those who have read, in my Letters from the Mountain, of my Venetian magic, will, I hope, find that sorcery had long been my vocation. Such was my life at Les Charmettes, when I was not occupied with country pursuits, to which I always gave the preference. And in anything which was not beyond my strength, I worked like a peasant. But it is true that my extreme weakness allowed me little merit on this point, except that of good intentions. Besides, I wanted to do two different things at once, and consequently did neither well. I had resolved to acquire a good memory by violent measures, and persisted in my attempts to learn a great deal by heart. With this object, I always carried some book with me, which I studied and repeated to myself while at work, with incredible pains. I cannot understand how it was that my persistency in these useless and continued efforts did not end by reducing me to a state of stupidity. I must have learnt and relearnt at least 20 times the eclogues of Virgil, and yet I do not know a single word of them. I have lost or dismembered numbers of books through the habit of carrying them about with me everywhere, in the pigeon house, in the garden, in the orchard, and in the vineyard. While occupied with something else, I put my book down at the foot of a tree or on a hedge. I always forgot to take it up again, and at the end of a fortnight I frequently found it rotted away or eaten by ants and snails. This eagerness for learning became a mania which drove me nearly stupid, so incessantly was I employed with muttering something or other to myself. The writings of Port Royal and the oratory, which I read most frequently, had made me half a Jansenist, and in spite of all my trust in God, their harsh theology sometimes frightened me. The dread of hell, which hitherto had had little terror for me, gradually disturbed my peace of mind. And if Mamma had not calmed my uneasiness, this terrible doctrine would have upset me altogether. My confessor, who was also hers, did his best to keep me in a comfortable frame of mind. This confessor was a Jesuit, named Father Aimé, a good and wise old man, whose memory I shall always revere. Although a Jesuit, he was as simple as a child, and his morality, rather gentle than lax, was exactly what I needed to counterbalance the gloomy impressions of Jansenism. This simple old man and his companion, Father Copier, often came to see us at Les Charmettes, although the road was very rough and the journey long for persons of their age. Their visits did me great good. May God recompense their souls, for they were too old at the time for me to suppose that they are still alive. I also went to see them at Chambéry. I gradually became quite at home in their house. Their library was at my disposal. The memory of this happy time is so closely connected with my recollection of the Jesuits that I loved the one for the sake of the other. And although I have always considered their doctrines dangerous, I have never been able to bring myself to hate them cordially. I should much like to know whether the same childish ideas ever enter the hearts of other men as sometimes enter mine. In the midst of my studies, in the course of a life as blameless as a man could have led, the fear of hell still frequently troubled me. I asked myself, in what state am I? If I were to die this moment, should I be damned? According to my Jansenists, there was no doubt about the matter, but according to my conscience, I thought differently. Always fearful, and a prey to cruel uncertainty, I had recourse to the most laughable expedients to escape from it. For which I would unhesitatingly have anyone locked up as a madman if I saw him doing as I did. One day, while musing upon this melancholy subject, I mechanically amused myself by throwing stones against the trunks of trees with my usual good aim, that is to say, without hardly hitting one. While engaged in this useful exercise, it occurred to me to draw a prognostic from it to calm my anxiety. I said to myself, I will throw this stone at the tree opposite. If I hit it, I am saved. If I miss it, I am damned. While speaking, I threw my stone with a trembling hand and a terrible palpitation of the heart, but with so successful an aim that it hit the tree right in the middle, which, to tell the truth, was no very difficult feat, for I had been careful to choose a tree with a thick trunk, close at hand. From that time, I've never had any doubt about my salvation. When I recall this characteristic incident, I do not know whether to laugh or cry at myself. You great men who are most certainly laughing may congratulate yourselves, but do not mock my wretchedness, for I swear to you that I feel it deeply. However, these troubles and alarms, perhaps inseparable from piety, were not lasting. As a rule, I was tolerably calm, and the impression which the idea of a speedy death produced upon my soul was not so much one of sadness as of peaceful resignation, which even had its charm. I have just found, amongst some old papers, a kind of exhortation addressed to myself, in which I congratulated myself upon dying at an age when a man feels sufficient courage in himself to look death in the face, and without having undergone any great sufferings, either bodily or mental, during the course of my life. My judgment was only too correct. A presentiment made me afraid of living only to suffer. It seemed as if I foresaw the destiny which awaited me in my old age. I have never been so near wisdom as during those happy days. Without great remorse for the past, free from all anxiety regarding the future, my dominant feeling was the enjoyment of the present. The devout, as a rule, possess a small amount of very lively sensuality, which gives a flavour of rapturous enjoyment to the innocent pleasures which are permitted to them. The worldly look upon this as a crime on their part. I do not know why. Or rather, I know quite well, they envy in others the taste for simple pleasures which they have lost themselves. This taste I had, and I found it delightful to satisfy it with a quiet conscience. My heart, still fresh, abandoned itself to everything with a childish pleasure, or rather, if I may venture to say so, with angelic rapture. For, in truth, these quiet enjoyments possess the serene charm of the joys of paradise. Dinners on the grass at Montagnole, suppers in the arbour, the gathering of the fruit, the vintage, the evenings spent in assisting our people to pull off the fibres of hemp. All these were so many festivals for us, which afforded Mamma as much pleasure as myself. Solitary walks possessed a still greater charm, because the heart had greater freedom of expansion. Amongst others, I remember one which marks an epoch in my memory, which we took on one St. Louis day, after whom Mamma was named. We set out alone, early in the morning, after having heard Mass read by a Carmelite at daybreak in a chapel attached to the house. I had proposed that we should stroll about the opposite side of the valley, which we had never yet visited. We had sent our provisions on ahead, for the excursion was to last all day. Mamma, although somewhat stout and fat, was a fairly good walker. We wandered from hill to hill, from thicket to thicket, sometimes in the sun and frequently in the shade, resting now and again, forgetting ourselves for hours, talking of ourselves, our union, and our happy lot, and offering our prayers for its continuance, which were not heard. Everything seemed in a conspiracy to enhance the happiness of that day. A shower of rain had recently fallen. There was no dust. The brooks were full of running water. A slight, fresh breeze stirred the leaves. The air was pure, the horizon cloudless. The sky was as serene as our hearts. We took our dinner at a peasant's house and shared it with his family, who showered upon us heartfelt blessings. What good people these poor Savoyards are! After dinner we reached the shade of some tall trees, where Mamma amused herself with botanizing amongst the underwood, while I collected some dry sticks to boil our coffee. Mamma pointed out to me 1,000 curious things in the structure of the flowers, which I had picked for her on the way, which greatly delighted me, and should have inspired me with a taste for botany. But the time for that was not yet come. I was too fully occupied by other studies. I was struck by an idea which diverted my mind from flowers and plants. My frame of mind, all that we said and did on that day, all the objects which had struck my attention, recalled to me the dream which I had had at Annecy 7 or 8 years before, of which I have given an account in its proper place. The resemblance was so striking that, when I thought of it, I was moved to tears. In a transport of emotion, I embraced my dear friend. "Mamma, Mamma," I said passionately, "this day has long been promised to me. I can imagine no greater happiness. My joy, thanks to you, is at its height. May it never decline. May it last as long as I feel its charm. It will never end, except with my life." Thus passed my happy days, happier since I saw nothing which could disturb them, and I only conceived it possible for them to end when my own end came. Not that the source of my anxiety was completely exhausted, but I found that it took a different course, which I did my best to direct towards useful objects, that it might carry its remedy with it. Mamma was naturally fond of the country, and this taste did not cool while she was with me. She gradually conceived a liking for country pursuits. She endeavoured to make her property a source of profit, and she took pleasure in making a practical use of her knowledge of such matters. Not content with the land belonging to the house, she rented a field or a meadow, directing her love of enterprise towards agriculture. She soon bid fair to become a regular farmer, instead of remaining idle at home. I was not particularly pleased to see her enlarging her sphere of occupation, and I opposed it as much as I could, feeling convinced that she would always be disappointed, and that her generous and extravagant disposition would always cause the expenditure to exceed the receipts. However, I consoled myself with the thought that these receipts would amount to something, and would help her to live. Of all the schemes she could possibly have thought of, this appeared to me the least ruinous, and without expecting any profit from it, as she did, I saw in it a continuous occupation which would protect her from unlucky undertakings and the machinations of swindlers. For this reason, I was eager to regain sufficient health and strength to enable me to watch over her affairs, and to be her foreman or head workman. And the exercise, which this obliged me to take, often took me away from my books and diverted my thoughts from my condition, so that my health was naturally improved. 1737 to 1741. The following winter, Barillot returned from Italy. He brought me some books, amongst others the Bon Tempi and the Cartella della Musica, which gave me a taste for the history of music and the theoretical investigation of this beautiful art. Barillot remained with us some time, and as I had attained my majority some months ago, it was agreed that in the following spring I should go to Geneva to claim my mother's fortune, or at least the share that came to me, until it should be discovered what had become of my brother.